Hello, and welcome to Searching for the Right Care. I'm your host, Jeff Santerre. And a little about this series, we realized in modern life that we're beset by any number of people seeking to influence our thoughts and actions with what seems like an infinite number of perspectives and opinions. Our work in this podcast is to help you pause to focus and reflect on things that matter in life and explore why. When we know why things matter, we make better decisions for ourselves and for our loved ones. Through this podcast series presented by the Right Care Alliance, we will explore various aspects of modern healthcare, including being involved with your healthcare, navigating our healthcare options, what the ideal healthcare system might look like, and so much more. So please join us each month as we tackle these and many more topics while searching for the right care. In our first episode, Advocating in Healthcare, we look at why patients have a difficult time talking to their healthcare providers, advocating for themselves. We'll talk to experts in the field and discuss ways we can become more comfortable with being a partner in our own healthcare.
So in this episode, we are going to be speaking with a couple of guests today. Our first guest is Julia Halisi. She is a practicing dentist in San Francisco, California, and has worked for over 20 years to improve the safety and quality of our healthcare system after her late daughter's cancer diagnosis. She was a founder of the Empowered Patient Coalition nonprofit and has created numerous patient education and engagement resources that are offered on her website, engagedpatients.org. Welcome, Julia.
Thank you.
And we also have with us Dr. Frederick Southwick. Dr. Southwick is a tenured professor of medicine and an active NIH-funded biomedical investigator for 30 years. He's presently the director of patient care quality and safety for the University of Florida Division of Hospitalist Medicine. Dr. Southwick is an active member of the Right Care Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to reforming healthcare so that it's affordable, safe, and accessible to all. And he's also the recent author of the book, Playing with Bees, Why Honeybees Hold the Key to a Better Healthcare System. Welcome, Dr. Southwick.
Thank you, Jeff.
And then we also have with us Victoria Guthrie. She is a ordained clergy person in the United Methodist Church in St. Petersburg, Florida, and she works extensively in her community with those in need. And thank you also, Victoria, for joining us, and welcome everybody. So tonight we want to begin with some information our listeners want to know about, such as when we're admitted to the hospital or being seen in the clinic, what do patients and families need to know and why? Healthcare is such a critical part of our lives, affecting much more than just our physical health. When we delve deep into the heart of the matter, this affects our income, our budget, our mental health, and so much more. Yet patients are just afraid to speak up or be more involved in their own decisions involving their health care. Why is that? Why are we so afraid to get involved and be a part of the solution? So Dr. Southwick, as a physician and champion of patient advocacy, why do you think it is?
Well, I think, Jeff, the problem is what we call a steep hierarchy. In other words, doctors are held up as ultimate authorities. And in some ways, that's very nice as a doctor. You feel very proud that you're an authority and you're respected. However, when you are held up that highly, the individual patients may be nervous to share their information. Oh, Dr. Southwick won't want to bother with that, or I can't ask him that question, that might threaten him. However, what I encourage is the way I put this is, look, I know I'm an expert on healthcare, but I'm not an expert on you. You're an expert on yourself, and you have a lot. I want to know what you're concerned about. That's the only way I can apply my expertise. So I think the important thing is for the physician to, right at the beginning, set groundwork for a level, even conversation and encourage patients. And what I found is patients often have terrific ideas. And when you look over medical errors, often the patient or the family has suggested a diagnosis that the doctors overlooked. And it turned out that was the correct diagnosis. However, the doctor ignored them. So I listen very carefully to every patient's suggestion. I may not follow them, but I will acknowledge them. I will investigate them. And the more we people get together and problem solve together, the more likely we are to get the right solutions. And remember, I always tell my medical students, who's spending 100% of their time concerned about their illness? It's the patient. While a doctor may have 6, 7, 8, 10 patients or 15 patients, So they don't have the full intention just on you. So that increased attention on the problem is very valuable. And so you are thinking about it 24 hours a day. The physician may think about it for an hour of that day, but not for the full time. So you are an expert. You have a lot to share. And it's very important that they be encouraged and that the doctor really stop and listen. One thing that I do when we go to the emergency room is we huddle around the patient and we ask, what brought you to the hospital? And then I tell everybody, don't interrupt. Let them go. And they'll usually do a minute and a half. They'll share some things, and actually that first dialogue, often I know what I can tell what's going on. I can tell what's concerning them, and we can address the issues that are of greatest concern, which they're most anxious with, in the first 5 minutes of our admission, and that's really important for both the doctor and the patient, and that it develops trust right away, and it says, your voice is important. Now, unfortunately, not every doctor is doing that, but we sure are training our medical students to act in that way. And I think more and more physicians are recognizing that is the way to really give the best possible care.
It's amazing because it sounds like such a novel concept and something that's probably should have been in place for years and years and years. But so, Julia, it brings up some interesting questions. So in your experience, with patients and the questions that they most want to ask but never do, why do you think that's the case? Why do you, maybe building on Dr. Southwick, what do you hear differently on the patient side?
Well, from my own personal experience, I think the whole basis of patients and families not speaking up is just a lack of basic knowledge. So we all know that knowledge is power. When you don't have knowledge, when you're thrust into a system that you don't understand, people are speaking a language you don't understand, nobody is going to be very active under those circumstances. So they have no basic foundation of knowledge to use. And I find the patient's biggest struggle seems to be asking for second opinions. In general, people feel that it demonstrates distrust or disrespect for the doctor, which is something Fred brought up just a minute ago. But I tell patients the reality is that doctors are routinely seeking second and even third opinions for themselves and for their own family members. They know that's a smart thing to do. I don't think they're intimidated by it. They shouldn't be, that's for sure. Patients also want to know how the hospital works. Basic things, who to ask for help, who is really making the decisions about their care, who do they approach if they're unhappy, unsure, something like that, and especially what they or their advocates can do to help stay safe and to avoid serious complications. Patients are very well aware that serious complications happen during medical care, and they want to know what they can do to help with the process, how they can be involved. And that's why we really wrote our hospital guide, which is on our website. It's a shortened version of my book, The Empowered Patient, which I wrote after spending over a decade in the system, managing my late daughter's illness. All the things that I learned, I put into that book. I am a highly educated healthcare provider, and I struggled over and over and over again to know what questions to ask, who to ask them of, how to keep my child safe. So I kind of funneled all of that into that hospital guide. I really feel that patients don't ask questions because they don't have a baseline of basic knowledge. They fear sounding uninformed. People will say, I don't want to sound stupid. That's a very uncomfortable feeling for people to feel like you're blurting out a statement based on no background of any information. They feel intimidated doing that. They worry about wasting the doctor's time. And frankly, if you have a very limited time with your providers, they're not going to sit there for an hour or two. They'll pop in during rounds. That may be your only contact the whole day with the main decision makers of your case. So you do want to be prepared. You want to ask the right questions, the important questions. And if you don't have any information to help you do that, any type of fact sheets, any type of reference guide that you can use, you're going to be at a big disadvantage.
So you, both of you bring up some great points. And I want to point out, both of you have worked not only within the system, being physicians and helping patients in that side, but have both also been patients that have had various things happen, both good and bad. So you understand both sides. And I can tell you, myself as being a patient, I've experienced care at its very best. And I've experienced it at its very worst in the emergency room, where I almost died because of a misdiagnosis. On the other side, my wife, Susan, has had cancer twice and has had a wonderful team of physicians in Shands at the cancer center that saved her life. And it's so remarkable, if that's the right word, to see both sides of it, to see the worst and the best. So that's one of the primary reasons I joined the Right Care Alliance. I felt like now I had a voice, and now I had an option to be part of my own healthcare and be part of the decision-making process. I've learned so much. I've learned it from Dr. Southwick over the years and guests such as yourself. So I feel like this is just a really valuable resource for people. I want to go to Victoria in St. Pete. Victoria, thank you for being part of the podcast tonight.
Thank you.
I know you not only volunteer with the RCA,
yeah,
but you also advocate for many in your own community. Can you just tell us a little bit about your work in St. Pete?
I am advocating not only for people in my churches who are often elderly, many of them are alone, so they don't have an advocate when they go into the hospital, and there's a lot of anxiety and fear around that. I'm also advocating for people who are displaced. They're homeless. They're struggling with food insecurity, and all of that is also impacting their health. And a lot of folks are not getting the health care they need because they don't know how to ask the questions. And also their health insurance isn't really covering it. So we're having to really struggle a lot with how to help folks and what questions they can ask that get them to the person they need to see.
So what would you say if you had to pick, and I know there's so many things because you've touched on a lot there, but what would be the most common or the most prominent question that you're asked of concerning healthcare?
Can you be my advocate?
Well, they're lucky to have you. I will say that. They're very lucky to have somebody that will look out for them. And,
yeah,
you know, you touched on something as well, because when we deal in situations with homelessness, not only are we dealing with medical issues that come up, we're also dealing with, as you said, food insecurities, and all of that affects mental health. And I think that's a part a lot of times that we kind of forget. You know, when we're ill, it takes a very severe toll on you mentally. And that's going to be a whole different podcast, but it brings up a lot of those points. We talk about how the patients need to be involved, how they need to ask the right questions. Patients should feel empowered to get involved at any level they're comfortable with and not afraid to ask. Julia brought up some great points about a knowledge level. It's just not there. A lot of us are not medically inclined. We don't know all the things. And I want to point out that the engagepatients.org, there's a lot of great resources. And I think that could be extremely helpful for people that are in there trying to make those decisions. Sometimes I think what happens as a patient, you feel like if you ask a question of your physician, or if you ask why something is happening, they feel like it's a challenge, like we're challenging their authority, challenging what they know. Dr. Southwick, I've known you a long time. I don't think you feel that way, but why would you think that that's the case? Or is it just too bold? Is somebody being out of line if they question if a procedure is needed, for instance?
Well, I think the way that doctors and patients need to think about this is we are collaborating together. We are working together to solve your health problem. And therefore, your voice is very important and your questions are very important. The other thing I tell our medical students when we're at a medical school, and my role is to teach not only the students, but also the patients. And if we don't spend the time to actually discuss what's going on with our patients, and even though it may go a little over their head, I think they're very comfortable with that. So one of the things that I emphasize is we always round when they're hospitalized around their bed. And we, the person who's presents to the patient. So we'd say, Mr. Jones, this has happened today. And it's very important that you not use doctor speak. So we are very careful about avoiding abbreviations. And I will coach. At first, they'll throw in some of these words, but over time, they get very, very good explaining things at more at an eighth grade level. And I think it helps everyone on the team. And so the whole team is listening to the person who's presenting, talking to the patient, but they're all learning together what's going on. And I think that really, I can tell you when you actually use the person's first name or last name, you see their face light up immediately. They really like that. And they really pay more attention. And therefore, they're empowered right from the start. You're empowering them to share their ideas and their concerns. And I think that's very important. And I think more and more doctors are doing that. And not all doctors do that. And I think the other thing is you shouldn't be confrontational. One of the important things is to generate mutual trust. So if a patient is harassing the doctor and saying, well, I heard this and I don't agree with this. Well, that's not going to establish a mutual trust. And similarly, if a doctor talks down to a patient and doesn't listen, that's not going to establish mutual trust. So it's really a trusting relationship. It's a very positive and constructive one because we both have the same goals. We both want to improve the patient's health and well-being. And in order for that to happen, the communication needs to be seamless, and it needs to be at a level that the patient can understand. Now, there are some patients that are just overwhelmed. And I think Julia in her website points this out, that many patients do need an advocate with them because their illness is too severe. They're too anxious. They're suffering. They're in pain. They're having symptoms that are frightening. And therefore, they're not able to really make good decisions. And so it's very helpful. And they may not hear what you say. That's the other problem. So it's very important to have another party there who is able to serve as a representative for them. And I think the data is quite good that when you have an advocate, the likelihood of an error drops significantly.
And probably for the patient, things that they might forget to bring up. You know, you're nervous, you're sick, especially if it's an ER situation. And that person certainly could probably help with that. I know in my case, certainly my wife has helped in past situations. So Julia, what do you think? I mean, we talked about advocacy and I know your proponent, Victoria, has talked about it. What can your advocates do maybe to get up to speed, if you will, or because you bring up a great point. If we, and all of you have it, if we don't understand the medical, we want to have at least some basics. So what kind of things could somebody do to prepare if they're going in, let's say, for a doctor visit or talking about a surgery or having an advocate, anything along that nature that you think might help out?
Well, I think certainly back to a couple of things Fred said, you know, two things, and also Victoria, that we don't do a very good job in this country of having that safety net in place for the people who really do not have an advocate and who cannot speak up for themselves. So they're relying on people like Victoria to do those sorts of things when we really need to provide a safety net of, and we do have social workers, there are patient advocates in the hospital, but a lot of times patients don't know to ask for that or they're not able to ask for that. So we're relying on the system to say, we're identifying you as kind of an at-risk person. We're gonna assign you these extra, you know, helpers. Sometimes that happens. Sometimes it doesn't, though, and people fall through the cracks. So we have to be better at recognizing who needs help and providing that for them. And then the reality is that some providers, some doctors, nurses, all sorts of providers are going to react in a way that might seem hostile, or it might seem irritated or annoyed. Maybe they're not used to patients who are more involved. Maybe they're in a rush. You know, our providers are usually under very serious time constraints in the system. Maybe they've had a bad day. Whatever the reality is for them, I think that patients have to realize it's a stressful situation for everybody. And you're not always going to be welcomed with open arms when you're asking questions or when you're a more involved patient. But I like to remind people of what's at stake. What's at stake is you or your loved one's life. That's ultimately what we're talking about, your recovery, your future. There's a lot on the line. And if that provider was the one in the bed and the situation was reversed, you know, they would be doing the same thing. So even if somebody seems annoyed, I think that you have to be able to overlook that and say, there's a lot more at stake here. I'm not going to get intimidated because somebody's attitude isn't exactly, you know, what I would think. Another thing with our resources that I found really helpful is it kind of makes this outside third party involved, where you can say, you know, I was given this, or I found this, or I have these resources. It's a checklist. It's, you know, some instructions. It's a list of a few important questions. I'd like to run through it so that somebody realizes that, you know, there's an outside entity who's kind of involved, that I'm not just willy-nilly thinking these things up. I'm not just trying to ask questions because I know I should ask questions, so I'm asking a lot of unimportant questions. These are questions that made sense to me, that they were, you know, written by outside advocates in organizations, and maybe they won't all apply to me, but I'd like to ask you at least these few. So a lot of our fact sheets are 10 things or 10 questions. You don't have to ask all of those. You don't have to start at number one and go to number 10. You know, glance through it, see what works for you. And also our resources are used very extensively, probably more extensively by people like Victoria than they are even by patients. So lots of social workers, lots of chaplains, lots of hospital advocates, lots of people out in the community who work with people at risk. They were the very first ones to jump on board and say, wow, we really need these, because people are coming to us and we're not prepared to really help them the way that we know they need to be helped. So as usual, I think it all starts with everybody involved around the patient. Their core, which is people like their own family, friends, neighbors, Victoria, people from their church, really all having access to those types of resources. So they have a starting point.
No, that's a lot of great points. I can tell you from the outside, when you have to go to the hospital, especially in an emergency situation, it almost feels like you're going into the haunted house. You don't know what to expect. You're going to get scared. It's probably not the best analogy, but from the patient's point of view, and I think from what you just said, if you have that advocate, if you have somebody that can be there, that can talk to you, that can help you talk to the doctor, I mean, what a win. So, and I think that all of us in situations like this, the Right Care Alliance, we need to get that out. I think more people need to understand that they don't have to be alone, because it's a lonely place to be when you're admitted with an emergency. It's a very little lonely place to be. So that brings us back to Victoria. You spent a lot of time advocating for patients. We've brought up some excellent points. So where are you able to help to find some of the resources that you need to help people? What do you kind of rely on as you're helping the different people within your community?
When people are particularly in the hospital, I can actually go in and ask for people. You know, I can ask for the patient advocate. I can ask for a chaplain, because I kind of have that, you know, I walk in, I give them my business card. I tell them why I'm here, that I'm this person's pastor, and we need to work together to get them what they need. So that's a lot easier sometimes for me to do than it is for them to do. And in the community, there's a lot of resources that I've kind of hooked up to. So I can say, okay, this is where you need to go. And I know they're going to get an answer. I'm not just going to send them to some place that's closed or that they can't get any help, because I'm not going to do that. They're not going to drive around for 50 minutes looking for something when they need one thing. Yeah. But even for me, sometimes I have to explain what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. Because I do get sometimes that kind of feeling of, why are you here? Are you interfering? You know, that kind of thing. Particularly if I get called to the hospital in the middle of the night, then I really need to explain what I'm doing. For the most part, for me, the getting the help is easy. The patients are usually just really under some distress. A lot of what I see is, you know, terminal illness. And so they're in the hospital and they're just on the edge of completely fracturing. So it does help to have someone there until family gets there, or until, you know, somebody can come and help them. But the other thing I've run across is sometimes there's a reluctance to be perfectly open about terminal illness. And so they have to really push to get answers because people don't want to distress them anymore. Sure. And some don't want the answer and some are really hoping to get an honest response.
And it's a tough situation. I mean, especially there. One thing I wanted to touch on, and this is from my own recent, unfortunately, a visit to the ER. And one of the things I noticed, and it seems to be a theme in what we're talking about, and Dr. Southwick talked about earlier, is communication. Not just that communication, which is so critical between the patient and the physician or physicians and the nurses. But one of the things I experienced is no communication between one part of the ER to the next part of the ER, and then being admitted upstairs and having to go through the entire thing again. And I think some of that was probably asking the questions to be, you know, 100%. I know in reading your most recent book, and we've talked about this, about that communication, what can we do in our, let's say in our hospital system, Dr. Southwick, to help that communication on the back end? In other words, with all the healthcare providers, what types of things are you seeing that are helping so that we have better communication? Everybody's kind of on that team that you talked about, standing around the bed.
Well, there are formal communication protocols that assure that you don't leave things out. And one of them is called IPASS, and it's illness severity, past medical history, assessment, what things that still need to be done, and then finally situational awareness and repeating back what you've heard. And they find that when you use IPASS, the errors drop by 80% as far as communication errors. Now that they've actually had now, this started in about 2015, and now they've been article after article after article. It's getting boring. They all show the same thing. And yet a lot of doctors are not, we can't get doctors to use IPASS. And one of the big problems I have, and I write about in the book, Playing with Bees, how do you get people to do the right thing? How do you get them to accept a standardized approach to communication that's proven to reduce miscommunication, has been proven to reduce errors and oversights in patient care? And I still don't have a great answer. I think it all has to do with leadership, and it has to do with how you frame things, and how you, if you can really encourage and show through, usually rather than showing statistics, see that 80%, oh well, but if you have individual patients where you can show that if that protocol had been used, their harm would have been prevented. I think individual cases are very, very important in creating meaning to a certain intervention. So I try to give stories whenever I can.
Thank you for joining us for part one of this discussion. In part two, we will further explore ways in which we can be a partner in healthcare and help advocate for ourselves and others in our communities. This has been a presentation of the Right Care Alliance. For more information, please visit rightcarealliance.org or contact the Gainesville, Florida chapter of the Right Care Alliance to find out how you can make a difference in your community. All rights reserved, copyright 2024.